Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz, we are live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. Tons of texts coming in here too. The Dunbar Lumber text line, including somebody saying, are we going to do the all your trade ideas are bad show, but just on Elias Pettersson future returns now? Are we going to pivot to that?
I can play that game. Actually, so on the one hand, I'm reluctant to get too far into it because I don't want to drive.
I am like extremely of two minds about this, yeah. Because
it's a story. It deserves to be talked about and mentioned. Don't get me wrong.
If I didn't work in the media and I was a fan, and, you know, I was talking to my buddies, like, we would 100% be, like, spitballing, what about this? What about this? 100%. Would this team be interested? Would they give up this? Like, 100%. Because it's fun and it's interesting.
On the other hand,
so
the
I
team,
love that, but I'm like, it just feels a little off when the team is first place and yada, yada, yada.
Feed into it.
Well, so I also, yeah, I mean, fundamentally, too, right? And I think, so I have two hypotheticals that I want to bring up to you, but I want to caption them like this, okay? I want to get into these because I actually think the conversation reinforces why this is not something to watch for ahead of March 8th. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, like, and I've never thought they're going to be in season. That would just be, like, that's unprecedented. Because you can throw the Tkachuk thing and that's, yeah, okay, that's like the roadmap we're kind of talking here, but like, whew, in season.
Yeah, right?
That would be something else.
So let me throw a couple hypotheticals at you just to, like, illustrate.
I would live for that chaos, by the way.
Nah.
We would put out.
It would be a big day for the station. I'm not going to lie.
We don't want it. We want a big run for the station, which requires
Exactly. Pedestal. I was going to say, it would be short-term gain, long-term loss.
Okay.
Anyways.
So the Carolina Hurricanes were bridesmaids in the Matthew Tkachuk sweepstakes.
All right.
Fearing that they might miss out again on a unique opportunity, they call and aggressively offer you, let's say, Martin Natchez, who's expiring, 25-year-old centerman, super productive, very good. And Brett Pesce. And you get to talk extension with Brett Pesce before. So one of the game's single best right-handed defensemen, and like a pretty consistent 70-point 25-year-old centerman. You get both those pieces. And I don't know, let's throw like an additional Felix Ungersorum prospect into the mix. Window dressing. Would you do that ahead of the deadline?
No, I don't think I would.
No.
Like,
relatively
easy. I don't think that improves your chances at winning the Stanley Cup.
Live
this year.
A little.
Stop it, Dumb.
Wouldn't that be great if
Dumb's the little devil over the shoulder of the
they
show?
They do
today?
A trade like that, and then at the presser, Rutherford's just like, YOLO.
Well, you only live once.
That was good. Did you just debut your Jim Rutherford impression? I like that.
Very solid.
I'm workshopping
it. Yeah, I like
very
that.
Very solid. The point of this, I think, is does that
the
trade,
bar for doing it in season will be extraordinarily high.
Does that trade make you 10% worse? Right? Because if it does, the leverage of getting 10% worse when you're at the top of the NHL standings, a franchise that has never won the Stanley Cup in its history, I mean, you know, that's massive, right? Like that leverage is massive. So here's another one that I think is maybe trickier. I actually saw Spitting Chicklets' Ryan Whitney bring up his name as, like, could it happen before the deadline? And I got me thinking. Say for whatever reason, Elias Pettersson was willing to extend with the Ottawa Senators.
All right, we're getting into real hypotheticals now.
Real hypotheticals.
Real hard to imagine.
But it's a thought exercise more than anything.
Sure.
And so they call and offer you Brady Tkachuk. Okay, Brady Tkachuk's like a 30-goal, 70-point, 6'4", 220-pound, super unique profile center. Signed this year and for four more afterwards at just over $8 million. And is the best. Like, Brady Tkachuk rocks.
Is he really a center, though?
Yeah.
He plays wing, doesn't he?
He's a forward, but he's a center.
All right.
What?
Yeah, no, that's fair.
You don't like him down the middle?
I think he's probably more of a winger.
No, he's a center. He's been a center way more regularly than he's been a winger in his NHL career. Anyway.
All right, anyways.
Yeah, what would you think about it?
So Brady, one for one?
One for one.
No.
You wouldn't even think about it.
Not in season.
Right.
I might at the draft.
Okay.
But I'm not passing up.
You don't even think it's a tough one?
Because the thing is, you have to, if you're giving up, if you were going to trade Patterson, I can't believe we're having this discussion, but if you were going to do it before the deadline, which is, what, less than 2 weeks away now, the other team is getting the extra value of an additional playoff run with Elias Patterson, right? So they have to further compensate you more than what you would want for a trade. Wow, that was exciting. More than what you would want for a trade at the draft. And so I could see a Patterson for Brady Tkachuk framework at the draft, but I think if you're doing it in season, Ottawa, now they're not going to make the playoffs, so again, this is very much a thought exercise here.
It is a thought exercise.
But I think the team acquiring Patterson, if they're like, okay, we have to go out and do it at the deadline, well, you have to pay a lot extra for that urgency. And we're already talking about an extraordinarily valuable trade asset. Now you got to pay more to get it done before the deadline. So I think that pushes the value out of the Brady Tkachuk one-for-one range.
Okay. I don't disagree. Look, fundamentally, this is an off-season question in my view. You need Pettersson. He is this team's most valuable forward. And if they're going to do anything in the playoffs, they need him on the team. They're at some point, this could come to a head this summer. At some point, this will come to a head this summer.
There's going to be some.
Because they either deal done.
If you're tired of the non-update updates on this, there will be real updates in the summer of some sort.
Absolutely. Well, there's all sorts of deadlines.
Yeah.
And various leverage points.
And like real deadlines. Because I know the trade deadline one has been kind of floated out there, but like it's not a real deadline.
No, but team elected arbitration deadline, yep. Qualifying offer deadline, market opens, and Patterson will be eligible to talk to teams as a free agent, albeit a restricted one. Arbitration hearing. I mean, there's also, one way or another, something will give in about 6 months. But in the meantime, this team's at such a high level, and this guy's too important to it for anything to give.
And somebody says, have you lost your mind? Rob from Victoria, have you lost your mind? Of course I'd make that trade any time, but the question is that trade going to be there in the summer? And that's the question with any of these hypotheticals, right? Are these teams, if they're so motivated to go get Patterson before the deadline, are there not going to be very, very similar deals available in the summer as well. So, you know, it's not that you have to do the deal right now. You have the ability to retain Patterson for a playoff run that you have already invested a lot in and you hope is going to be a long one. And then you would have the freedom to explore these options down the road.
You absolutely do not have to worry about managing the value of a 100-point center.
No.
Just like flat out. Don't even worry about it.
No, and that's why also like the flip side of this is, and I don't have the text right in front of me, but, you know, we've seen versions of this like, hey, is this just Patterson betting on himself? You know, if I have a great playoff run, does that set me up to make even more money? And you never know. That could be a little bit about it. But Patterson's value is pretty much as close to assured as you get right now, right? Like if he hits 100 points for a second straight season, you're into, it doesn't really matter what you do in the playoffs territory. You're going to be a consecutive 100-point center. That's going to get you paid an awful lot. Look, hey, some exceptional performance, could it eke a little bit more money out? Yeah, sure, maybe. But like Patterson, he's performed so well the last couple of years. He almost doesn't need to grind his leverage that much to get an incredible deal.
Well, he doesn't. But don't ignore the potential, especially if he's willing to do, for just raw business case.
Mm-hmm.
If he was willing to accept his QO, which is $8.8 million,
mm-hmm.
and take it 12 more months, there is the possibility that he could hit the open market at the age of 26 as a three-time 100-point centerman with a $95 million upper limit of the salary cap.
Yeah.
$17 million?
Woo.
16? No, truly, like, blow up your paradigm of what you think the best players in the NHL make if it played out that way. I don't think that matters to him personally. That's my sense of it. I don't think that actually matters to him. But if you were like a super business-minded individual, if maximizing your income was your number one priority, I mean, there is absolutely a playbook, and not one that's going to take like years to play out at this point, like 18 months from now, where he could fundamentally detonate the paradigm for what the top players in this league make. He's set up to do that. If he cared to. I don't think he is. I don't think he does. But don't ignore that.
Yeah, but I don't get the sense that's what's driving this.
It's not.
Primarily.
No, it's not. But when you're talking about like there's not too much more that he you're right in terms of his performance, but
let's say to sign this summer.
Right.
That number is pretty much locked in, whatever
sure.
he wants, you know?
But it's just this was my reaction to the, like, 12 times 8 storyline, was it's like, I'm not convinced that that's a no-brainer offer level for a player at this point. You know, this cap dynamic, which is outside either party's control, I do think makes this a truly unique one. To bring it back to our old friend Timofey Mozgov.
Yes.
The patron saint of the Canucks talk
By the
program.
Way, I think it was after our last show that somebody suggested that Dakota Joshua could be the Timofey Mozgov, which I thought was a very interesting.
It needs to be someone who hits the year after,
so
in
not
my
this
opinion.
Year. All right.
You know what I mean? Because like we're going to get a $5 million
A little
lift,
bit of an increase, yeah.
But it's like there's a real possibility that you could get like a $5 million and then an $8 million in consecutive years, and then... I mean, what do contracts even look like at a $95 million upper limit?
Yeah.
I don't even know.
There's
going to
be
a
big adjustment.
It's a huge adjustment. It's going to be fun.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Look, there's still lots of Pettersson talk coming in here. And we'll try to pivot in a second. But this one came in. Do you think the team is getting ticked off with all this uncertainty for the future? And then somebody else texted in, related regarding the locker room. Could this possibly be filtering into the locker room because PD is holding up all the other UFA, RFA contracts, even for free agents who want to stay? And as you pointed out, one of the things that caught your interest the most from Rick Dhaliwal's reporting was the idea that this is becoming a distraction for the team. Now, Dhaliwal didn't specify like what levels, who's distracted, what the exact dynamic is, but I do think that's really interesting. And if I was management, yeah, I'd be pretty frustrated that you don't have, like, this is the first domino that you want to take care of, and you've got a lot of work to do this summer, let alone ahead of the trade deadline, to put this team in the best position to go win a Stanley Cup. This is the first domino that you would want to take care of in an ideal world, and you're not able to. Now, the question about the other players on the team, and if you're a pending UFA, and if the word you're getting is like, hey, we can't really do anything right now until PD signs, I could see that being frustrating, but that's just pure speculation. I don't know, but I do think it's not surprising, and this is why I've never fully gotten on board with the, well, he said he'd talk after the season, so what's everyone so concerned about? Because that has material consequences for the team. The team can't really afford to just say, like, all right, we'll check in May. They have all this other work they want to do. So it's fine. Like, Pettersson's allowed to take that approach, but it's not a mystery why the team would then get a little impatient with that approach.
Absolutely. When Rutherford and Alvin were talking to the media, I think it was on this station. In fact, I know it was with on Canucks Central. Back in December, I was like stunned by how explicitly they were willing to admit that there are real team building benefits to cost certainty.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's something that I always say, like it's like one of my classic rules, and yet I don't expect team executives to ever admit it. You know, but it's self-evident. Like it's obviously true. And that's sort of, one of the costs of making the wrong bet on an elite player's second contract. You know, you bridge them and they become superstars. That can make you sweat. You bridge mm-hmm. them and they struggle. That can make you sweat. I mean, there's all sorts of various permutations. And, this isn't distinct. Like, we literally went through this two summers ago with Brock Besser on the opposite end of the spectrum where he'd sort of struggled.
Yep. Low ebb of his value. Yep.
And guess what happened? 18 to 24 months of unmitigated, ceaseless, unyielding speculation. You know, like, This is the dynamic that the Canucks selected when they handled Pettersson the way they did back in the summer of 2021. You know, it's like all fruit from the poisonous tree now. No one should be surprised it's become a story. No one should be surprised that it's something of a distraction. No one should be surprised that there are sharks in the pond trying to see if that thing they smell is blood in the water, right? Like, no one should be surprised by any of this. That said, you know, like Daisy Jones and the Six, you know, like at some point you can have friction in your band, but you've got a pretty cool concert to play over the next couple months. Just like finish the tour.
Yeah.
You know, that's got to be the focus. Finish the tour with the group you have because it's working pretty great and we're all enjoying that.
Leave it off the ice, right? Like, yep. put it aside when you step out there. And look, hey, this team has done that. As much as it's becoming a distraction, Pettersson quote unquote, they've done that. Dom,
you guys know how much I love to quote Moneyball.
I did not know that.
I didn't either.
I'll take your word for it.
I famously claimed on this station that Moneyball is the reason why so many analytics-based people like Dom LeCision are now so prevalent in sports. To quote Moneyball, I love the idea that there's some intern within the Canucks organization that would go up to Rutherford or Patrick and pull the Jonah Hill line of, I think it's a good thing that you got Elias Pettersson off your books. I think it opens up a massive amount of possibilities.
Sorry, wait, you're saying that?
I love the idea that there could be someone in the organization that would mimic a Jonah Hill in this case, being like, man.
Looking for the bright side, you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, look.
I mean, there's definitely people who will say that about just about any player, no matter how good they are. And partly what we've seen is the Canucks go all in, you know, on glue guys as opposed to higher price guys, with a lot of those guys hitting at high volume, sort of helping to power their rise up the standings. But let's not ignore that the fundamental reason that this team's performed the way they have is like Demko, Hughes, Pettersson, Miller have all been at the apex of their powers, all healthy, all available all season, right? And like hitting at the same time for the first time in their sort of partnership, right? There's always been like one guy's hurt, one guy's struggling. All four going at the same time has been a powerful, powerful thing for this team.
So are you saying you can't replace Elias Pettersson in the aggregate?
I am. And here's partly why. Usually when someone says that about like a Jason Giambi, it's because they're being an age snob. Like, well, he's 30.
Right.
Who knows what it looks like in 2 years? You can't say that with a 25-year-old guy.
Now, I will say, Dom, it's not entirely wrong. Like, I was on the morning show last week saying, like, there are people texting in, just trade him, whatever, go get the haul, they'll be better off. To me, I don't see how you get closer to winning a Stanley Cup by trading Elias Pettersson. Having said that, a mitigating factor, it doesn't change that math, but a mitigating factor is with the return and the cap space, the possibilities are endless after that, right? Like, you can choose a lot of different things to pursue and do.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that makes it a good thing. I'm just saying that's what you would have to embrace. You'd have to embrace that idea of, okay, we've got a ton of different possibilities now. We're not locked into any one thing. Let's be flexible. Let's be open. Let's see what develops out there for us. And that can be a good thing. Doesn't mean it's the best of the options. I would stop well short of saying that. I absolutely don't agree with that. You want to keep a player like Elias Pettersson as long as you can. But it's something. If you're trying to look on the bright side, it's not completely illegitimate, is what I'm saying.
But at the end of the day, and I have no intel to say that this is true.
Oh, really? You don't?
I don't. Despite what some people may think, you know, Jamie.
Are you still talking about your Moneyball hypothetical?
If a player doesn't, no. Although I will bring those up from time to time. If a player doesn't want to be here, you have to do what's best for your franchise. You have to maximize what you can extract from a player that doesn't want to be here.
We all agree. It's just that what's best for your franchise is to not do anything for another 2 weeks and then revisit in the summer, try to get the deal done again, and only as a last resort. And by the way, that matches where the Canucks seem to be based on all this reporting, right? Which is our goal is to get him signed. Our goal is to get him signed.
To get him signed. We want to get him signed. They've been very consistent in that. They're 100% correct. Now, if something happens that makes that impossible, then you got to pivot, of course. But
and let's not ignore either. Like, is it unusual for a player as good as Pettersson to get to this point? A little bit. that's a little bit unusual. Is it unheard of? Hardly, right? The Sedin twins got well past this point. Steven Stamkos got well past this point. I mean, we've seen players get to the point of meeting with rival teams, hearing pitches, and then deciding to stay where they're at. You know, like, this story's not run. This isn't an inevitability, and it shouldn't be discussed in that club. What we know about the club's posture here matches what we'd expect of their rational self-interest, right? What we know about Pettersson's stance, well, we don't know anything about Pettersson's stance beyond that he always said that he'd want to wait until after the year. And that's kind of where we're at. It's more than anything, like when we were tossing the hypotheticals out earlier this segment, it's just the thought exercise, right? The thought exercise of like, well, if you can't even come up with a glorious deal you'd consider that doesn't involve the New Jersey Devils sending the entire Hughes family to Vancouver, then it doesn't make sense to do it. You got to wait. And that seems to be where the Canucks are at.
All right. We'll probably get back into this conversation at some point because there's a lot of appetite
after
for
today.
This.
After today, can we sideline it?
Oh, it's going to go back on the back burner for a while. Anyways, I think so. I mean, we'll see. You'll never know what the next report is going to be. But it's game day tomorrow, and then trade deadline. Look ahead, all of that.
I think until the deadline passes, this is going to be not. Maybe it's not front burner, but it's like...
I just don't see the deadline. The deadline is like a totally artificial date as relates to this 100%. Story. So it's like the deadline passing shouldn't really mean anything, I don't think.
The deadline will only matter because it's going to be like, what are teams doing? And it's in that context that the Pettersson story is just going to keep like popping its head up.
All right, we'll talk a little Petey, but we'll talk just the Canucks in general, thoughts about the Bruins game, looking ahead to the week to come with Kevin Woodley from NHL.com in Goal Magazine. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline, brought to you by Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. The first call, the only call, and we're just waiting to get Kevin Woodley on the line here from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine. Always a pleasure to have Woodley on the show. And in fact, we do have him right now. So we'll go to the Dispatch Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning hotline. The first call, the only call, to our guest, as mentioned, from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine, Kevin Woodley, a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. Kevin, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. I'm actually in my White Rock Hyundai. Perfect. The Ionic 6, as I head towards Penguins practice at 1:30, find out whether they have Brian Rust on the trip or not.
Very good. Big game coming up against the Penguins tomorrow, so we'll look forward to some
the
intel
Lord's
from you
work,
on that
Woodley.
One.
You're doing the Lord's work.
I was gonna say, you must put in more FaceTime with the visiting team than anyone else in Vancouver.
Oh, by
media.
A mile. He's always in the room.
Yeah, and I mean, the reality is, this used to be standard, and I get it. Like, I'm not complaining about the way the industry's changed, but it's so hyper-local now. Like, I remember in the past where, especially the Penguins, like Sid or Mario before him, because, yes, I'm old enough to have covered him. A trip by them would automatically warrant visiting media, or Vancouver media coverage of the team, like, extensive. Like, multiple cameras, multiple reporters, both newspapers having feature stories sort of setting it up. And, you know, again, I know why it's hyper-local. I know that's what the audience wants. But I do wonder at the National Hockey League level a little bit, in a gate-driven league where even during this run of Canucks success, and yes, I believe every ticket is sold, but they're not accounted for. Like, there were blocks of empty seats against the Bruins the other night. I kind of wonder whether that coverage is missed, frankly.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. And as you said, look, this is a high-profile team and a really fascinating team in the Penguins right now as well, given how their season has gone and what they might do at the deadline. What are you curious to see from the Penguins on Tuesday and kind of find out a little more at practice today as well?
Well, I want to have a discussion with the people involved, obviously, in the goaltending department, because the numbers, you know, aren't there for Jarry or Nedeljkovic after a really good start. They've leaked a little bit more defensively. Like, you know, this was the team when they won two cups that sort of created or sort of generated this recognition of the importance of laterals, both in terms of scoring goals by going east-west offensively, but the importance of shutting them down. You know, I know that the Washington Capitals, armed with the data from the Penguins Cup runs, like, focused on how they attacked and how they defended, specifically with an eye towards those slot line, or what we were calling at the time Royal Road plays, using data from ClearSight Analytics, to the extent where, you know, the Capitals goalie coach got a voice in, you know, emphasizing how they attacked on odd man rushes. So, you know, how much of that has eroded based on the rest of the league catching up on the importance of it? How much is it just in terms of personnel eroding? How much of this is, you know, goaltending not being able to bail them out? And then obviously, like, lineup questions for a team that's going to be tough to make the playoffs as is, with questions about Gensel, who's already out, and whether he's going to be on the trade market. Like, whether Brian Rust is here for this road trip or not could be significant, because it's a tough trip at a time where they need wins, and you wonder if, you know, any dip sort of further reinforces Kyle Dubas's plans or plans of action heading into the trade deadline.
What did you think of the Canucks' performance against Boston on Saturday?
You know, I thought for two periods they were shut down pretty effectively by a Bruins team that, you know, knows how to defend, protects the front of its net very well, and had the added bonus of wanting to play a really clean, tight game so they could get a green light, because Saturday night was their rookie party here in Vancouver. So, you know, I kind of wasn't surprised by the first two periods. I was impressed by their ability to break through in the third against it and obviously win in overtime. And yet, you know, even with that, it took a 6-on-5 goal to tie it up, right? Like, we're still looking at 1 5-on-5 goal against a good defensive team in Boston at the end of the night. You tie it up 6-on-5 and you win in overtime in a 4-on-3. So, it was a really good bounce back result. The third period was a really good bounce back effort. I liked that they didn't come out of their structure to chase the game early when it was evident how difficult it was going to be to generate offense against Boston. Like, that's a real positive. These are the games, regardless of how you win them, these are a little more indicative of what you're likely to face in the postseason, especially if you get through the first round and things are likely to tighten up. And so, after a couple where they lost tight games, I think of Winnipeg, I think of Colorado, you know, in it till the third and end up losing, this one they come out on the right side of it. So there was a lot to like, and yet, you know, as much as it's celebrated in the market, I don't know that there was anything huge or definitive about it.
Woody, I'm curious to know, because you're right, the composure for me was the standout attribute of Vancouver's win, but I'm curious to know, does the first 50 minutes and how little they generated that Swayman couldn't see, does that stand out to you as like a concerning template at all, given that it sort of matches what we saw against Winnipeg and Colorado over this recent stretch?
Yeah, and again, the fact that, I mean, great set play to get the first one, but it takes a 6-on-5 to generate a look with Swayman's eyes taken away to tie the game. I don't know if I'd say concerning, Thomas, but it shows you the importance of getting to those areas. And I know you and I have talked about sort of, you know, screens and the value of them. And you know, you can generate offense that way. It's, I believe that a lot of people don't understand how high value some of those chances are. And if you're an effective team at taking away goalies' eyes, you can create a lot of offense that way. But there is inherently a coin flip element to it, because getting those pucks through when teams collapse and take away lanes, again, anything short of a 6-on-5 is difficult. And so, yeah, if you create a layered screen or a flash screen like Brock did and you hit the top of the net with a release that's timed as well as Hronek's was or a screen as well timed as Brock's is, those go in like 40% of the time, and that's great. But finding lanes to get those through and actually hit the top of the net without getting it blocked or hitting a bunch of legs, like that's a lot more difficult task. And you are relying on, yes, a little bit of the grittiness to get there, skill to find a lane and get a puck through. But even then, there's some randomness in terms of getting it through all those bodies.
And in terms of this team sort of overcoming, you know, their brief weird losing streak, how are you seeing their game trend since the All-Star break? Because on the one hand, that four-game winless stretch feels kind of blip-like. A lot of weirdness in there, especially that Wild game, that deeply uncharacteristic Kraken game. And yet, it's now an 11-game sample, .500 hockey since the All-Star break. Is that noise or signal in your view?
Well, I mean, a little bit of both, right? Because we know, we sort of have an idea of why, because the anomalies are part of that, right?
Mm.
Like, the Kraken game as a, you know, nobody looked like they had their legs. I think you can write that off as an anomaly. The Wild game, I mean, you know, how many times are you getting 4 or 5-on-3s against you in a game, right? So, you know, and as much as I talked about them not generating against the Bruins, defensively, that was one of their best games of the season. Like, they only, like, Boston had 1.36 expected goals. They only gave up 4 high-danger chances to the Boston Bruins. So, I don't know that we've seen outside of the Seattle game and the mini game and the period against Winnipeg where they, you know, chased a hit, made a mistake. Like, I don't think we've seen what to me is the foundation of their game, and that is the way they defend and how little they give up off the rush. I don't think that has fundamentally shifted or deteriorated significantly.
And on Elias Lindholm, you know, he has been really good defensively. We've heard from Rick Tocchet. You know, we haven't necessarily seen that that level of offensive upside, but has he been an effective add just because he does play into what you're talking about, right? This team's identity of their ability to be so stout defensively, he's just another piece, it seems like, that can really contribute to that, you know, up and down the roster.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I don't know that the investment was made with an eye towards him being your third line guy. But if that's what you've got, because the fit isn't there on either of the top two lines, it certainly fits that identity. Absolutely. Like, if you're not going to get the offensive push, at the very least, you know, you get that out of Elias Lindholm. And if that is your foundation, and like I said, I think it has been since they got here, that's not a bad thing. It may not have the upside you were hoping for when you paid as much as you did to get him, but at least it doesn't become it's not a negative at the end of the day.
The power play has been a big story, you know, not just in that 4-game losing streak, but stretching back before that a little bit. Now they score in overtime against the Bruins. It's a 4-on-3 power play, but still get on the board. But in terms of the numbers, what are you seeing in terms of the chances, the types of chances, the volume, all of that they're generating 5-on-4 recently?
We can all see it, right? It's not there. Like, there were times earlier in the season where the underlying numbers were good and maybe it wasn't going in, not even for small stretches, but we've seen sort of the underlying erode as well in the last little while, right? Like, the PKs, that's been a problem all year. And, you know, to Thomas's point about what trends have we seen since the All-Star break, to me, special teams is the biggest one. Like, 5-on-5,
no question.
I don't think it's changed. But when you don't have that power play in your back pocket to bail you out, to get a goal, to create pressure, or even generate momentum. And that, to me, is the difference. Like, even during other short periods, and there weren't many this season where it wasn't clicking, the underlying was still there. You could see the chances being generated. Even if they're not a rate team on the underlying numbers on the power play, they were still in the top 10. And, you know, like, I think the Seattle game, I think of the Colorado game, like I'm trying to think of which one it was. It was the Colorado one where they only had two power plays, and they generated
next to nothing, like a shot each, and they were both low danger. And that to me would be more concerning than anything we're seeing at 5-on-5. And then when you look at the personnel, it's concerning with an asterisk because you're not worried about them figuring it out. But if they don't, that becomes a problem because, you can only rely on sort of the layered screens and things like that at 5-on-5 to a certain extent. So, I think this team's that needs to be in their arsenal, an effective power play. Again, talked about, generating goals at key moments in games rather than the overall numbers and how that's what matters most to him. And I think there were times on that trip where, forget generating goals, they weren't even generating scoring chances. And that's the one that's a little bit concerning. But again, with the asterisk that, are you worried about it long-term? Probably not.
So I agree with you about the special teams trend being the most troubling since the All-Star break, but big picture, I think my biggest concern, I have two things that I actually worry about when it regards this team. One is 5-on-5 offense. In your view, do they generate enough, even accounting for these layered screens, some of the good work that they do at the net front, do they generate enough 5-on-5 to reliably threaten against some of the best defensive teams in the league, in your view?
Based on the underlying numbers they have in all season.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, the underlying numbers have sort of indicated that all year, whether it's the public stuff, and I know you've talked about it, or the proprietary stuff I have. Like, a lot of their underlying is, as much as they're incredible defensively, they don't give up rush chances. Like, they don't create much off the rush.
Mm-hmm.
They have relied on finishing. And I guess the answer is to be seen. Like, that's why this little stretch is so fascinating. And that's why I still think there's, a bit of a question mark around the Bruins game. Because when you did finally break through, it was 6-on-5. And obviously you can't count on scoring to tie games with your goalie out as a steady recipe. So, I do think that their ability to generate those types of looks against better defensive teams, against elite teams, at 5-on-5 and to create offense is a fair question still at this point. For long stretches of this season, the profile has looked the same, and it hasn't mattered because of A, the finishing talent on this team, but also B, they do, in ways that aren't measured by the public numbers, the screens and things like that, they do generate better quality chances, and they do have guys like Hughes on the back end that can find the top of the net through traffic, and guys like Besser who, really have been so good at taking away goalies' eyes and strategically so, not just go to the net
because
good things happen, but, actual strategy behind it. And guys like Miller who work off that so well. But are you willing to get there? Can you get there? Will you go there and create, or will those lanes be available for the defenseman when you do against upper echelon defensive teams? And, I think that's still to be determined. To this point, they've been fine. The little blips we've seen that they've come against Winnipeg, that they've come against Boston, a little bit against Colorado. There's an eyebrow raise, but not to the point where, you're in panic about it. I don't think you could ignore how much they've outscored those underlying to this point in the season, even if it's some of it has been against lesser teams.
The other thing that I, at the end of the day, just worry a little bit about, right? So Thatcher Demko, only Alexander Georgiev and UC Saros have started more games than Demko has, right? In terms of shots against, fourth in the league. He's faced 1,300 shots at this point. In his NHL career, Demko's played more games than this once, right? The 64 games that he played with really heavy usage down the stretch during the Bruce There It Is bump. And we all kind of know how that ended. DeSmith, and we talked about in the press box a bit, Woodley, but 844 since the calendar turned to 2024. A lot of that skewed by that Wild game, obviously. But is the temptation there to ride Demko down the stretch? How much usage is too much? And how attentive should the Canucks be here in terms of making sure to manage his load with an eye toward game one of the postseason?
You have to be attentive to it. Do I worry that he's the same goaltender physically that he was in that Bruce Theridis season? I'm not as worried about that, right? Like, yeah. I've talked about the changes he's made in terms of how he trains and, you know, not pulling his body apart, even playing a system and a style that at times, like, the level of pace that he goes into posts with, like, it's almost violent, right? That explosiveness is a big part of his game, and so injury is always going to be a risk. But it's also what gives you the upside, his right. ability to beat plays. So I'm less worried about that because of the changes he's made to how he trains. Am I worried about them going away from DeSmith? Yeah, a little bit, just because, like, everybody asks the same questions in Edmonton of me because of Skinner's workload, which has also been really high. But your hand is forced in Edmonton because of all the back-to-backs. It's more tempting here because you don't have those back. I think the Oilers still have six left or seven left. So you know Skinner's not playing those games, and that'll keep it down automatically. We don't have that here in Vancouver. I think there's only one left. So, you know, every second day, hey, he feels good. You could do it. I mean, and it's easy to buy into that, especially if he's telling you my body feels great. We've just seen, you know, like for a long time now that guys that play that number of minutes don't end up winning cups. Is it the reason they don't end up winning cups? Not all the time, but like it's kind of hard to ignore the math. And if this is an all-in season, then I do think it's important to sort of continue to manage those minutes and find that balance between making sure he has enough time to stay sharp in his game, but also on top of his health. And so that means playing Casey DeSmith. And I, you know, it's funny, you and I talked about this in the press box the other day, Thomas, because I was curious too. Like, it's tough when you have a game like the Minnesota game. It just absolutely craters your stats. Like, just craters your stats to the point where when you're not playing that much, like, a night like that for DeSmith, even though there were no low-danger goals that went in on him, you know, it just undoes you. I think there were eight high-danger chances and seven went in. And, you know, yes, they're high-danger chances, but goalies are expected to stop some of them, and he didn't. So he's not going to be able to recover statistically from that, given how little he plays. I would hope that the team doesn't go away from him based on that. Like, again, we talked about anomalies. Recognize that's an anomaly. The start before that wasn't his best. So, but take away those two starts, and from December 1st up until that window, like, he was plus 2.3% save percentage-wise. Like, that was top 10, top 15 in the league. He'd gone on a nice run in limited action, and, you know, don't forget that how hard that is to sit for 2 weeks and then go into a pressure start. So I don't think the temptation is there, but I think they're aware of the need to avoid it. And like I said, I don't care what you say about DeSmith's numbers from, you know, one point to the next, if they include that Minnesota game. You take away his last two starts, he's been just fine. I know the raw numbers have come down, and of course they were going to, because as I was saying at the beginning of the year when everybody was losing their minds about a 918 save percentage, he had one of the highest expected save percentages in the league. They were defending exceptionally well in front of him. That's dropped by 10 points since then. And so obviously his other numbers are going to come down. You know, pull the Minnesota sample out and things aren't that bad. I think they've got to recognize, and I believe they will recognize the importance. And it could be as soon as tomorrow night against his former team that they're going to recognize the importance. But that's a tough one, right? Like, if you were planning to start him, but hey, we lost four in a row and now we got some momentum back, we got to go with our number one guy. Those are the discussions then that can lead to all of a sudden the playoffs started. Oh, crap, we played him 63 games. What were we doing?
And, you know, we've heard Rick Tocchet speak recently, or certainly during that four-game losing streak when they were on the road, about the desire for more practice time. On the goalie front, you know, as they get into March here, they're going to have a lot more practice time and a lot more space between games than they've had recently. How does that play into, you know, the balance of trying to keep Demko fresh but rested? How much does that affect, you know, how, their usage plan for him and, again, keeping him fresh and ready to go for the playoffs?
You know, like, I think that's very much a conversation amongst them and with the goalie coach, right? Like, and Demko being honest about how he feels. And, like, it'll be I'm kind of curious to see how they balance this out in terms of down the stretch and what minutes he's at in practice, how much they even get to practice, right? So I don't know the answer. You know, I know Tocchet talked about even bringing the practice goalie on the road. I'm not sure that's going to happen. I don't know what this plan looks like. But, you know, like, right back to the beginning press conference of the season, you know they're cognizant, you know, listening to Rutherford talk about the importance of it. You know they're very aware of this, right? So Ignoring it now when you're at the top of the league of all times, it just seems unlikely to me that they're going to not continue to be aware and continue to find that balance, whether it's in games or whether it's in practice, utilizing a practice goalie to make sure you give them extra rest. And quite often that's get out with the goalie coach early, do your drills, feel good about your game, and then get off. Like that's how Dubnyk played the, what was it, 32 or 37 in a row the first year he arrived in Minnesota. They had three NHL goalies. Dubie would go on with the goalie coach for 20 minutes. He'd do one or two drills, and then he'd bugger off. That's the type of thing you can do to make sure your goalie stays more rested down the stretch.
Kevin, always a blast to have you on. Thanks for doing this. We'll chat again soon.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley from NHL.com, In Goal Magazine. Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650 was brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or WhiteRockHyundai.com. We'll take a break here. Lots to get into still. And, you know, we talked about a little bit about Elias Lindholm there with Woodley, but there are some interesting on-ice things. Yeah, believe it or not, not just Pettersson stuff. Some interesting on-ice lineup things to get into from Saturday night's game, which we will do on the other side. Look ahead a little bit to the week to come for the Canucks. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. You can send your thoughts in. We'll be back right after this here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Big opinions and good bets. It's the People's Show with Bick Nizar. Be sure to subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. Live from the Kintech Studio, 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Just an update. Kevin Woodley mentioned this as he was en route to Pittsburgh Penguins practice. I just saw the Penguins tweeting. Coach Sullivan confirms that Brian Rust is still being evaluated, did not make the trip to Western Canada. So no Jake Guentzel, of course, and now no Brian Rust for the Penguins when they face the Canucks tomorrow night at Rogers Arena. As mentioned, 650. Go ahead.
Quietly, I think you want to win that game very badly. Like, not that you don't want to win every game very badly, but the... I don't think you want the losers in 5 and 6
no
thing hanging over you, especially going into a really tough spot against the LA Kings. You know,
yeah, and you're at home now. You've had a chance to like the games are starting to thin out a bit, yeah. Right? You're catching up on your lack of rest and all of that. Pittsburgh, I know they won on the weekend, but like they've been super inconsistent and up and down. Now they're shorthanded. You've got that Kings game looming. Absolutely. And not to mention all of the connections between these teams.
You also had a game with some like real bad feeling against them. You know, like last month, played really well, won, but it was exciting. It was combative. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun. Also, Sidney Crosby playing in this building.
Big deal.
I was thinking about it because I was listening to the players you need to see live ranking in an NBA podcast last night. It was the Bill Simmons podcast. Even though he's not affiliated with Sportsnet.
You can give him a plug. It's all right. I don't think he's a direct competitor.
Has anyone heard of him? It's a niche podcast.
Has heard this little podcaster down in the States?
Anyway, I was thinking about it in hockey terms, and I was thinking, like, Crosby's got to be right up there in terms of players you have to see live, because there becomes this legacy component to it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, you want to be able to say, I saw Sidney Crosby.
Yeah, like I was, you know, planning out my schedule for the next month, and I was like, well, I'm not missing that. Every chance I get now to watch Sidney Crosby play live, I have to take.
Big deal.
Yeah, because he's history. It's history now. So anyway, it was just a thought.
And he's a pleasure. Still. Yeah, still an absolute pleasure to watch do his thing and play live. So that's what's going on with the Penguins. We'll look more into that, talk more about the Penguins game tomorrow. But as mentioned, you know, we saw the Canucks coming off that four-game losing streak. And really, that four-game losing streak took on a lot more weight with the Seattle loss and the commentary from Rick Tocchet following the Seattle loss, right? That's what took it from like, weird game against Minnesota, a couple close games against good teams to, oh, this is a little bit concerning now, at least from my point of view. And in light of that, Rick Tocchet tries some new lineup configurations on Saturday against the Bruins. And probably the most notable aspect of this was for the first time since they acquired Elias Lindholm, they went with the strength down the middle approach of Miller, Pettersson, Lindholm, and Bluger as the four centers in the lineup. And hey, one of the things we instantly said when they acquired Elias Lindholm was his flexibility is off the charts, right? And for the ultimate puzzle guy in Rick Tocchet, he was acquiring a piece that he could use in so many different roles, in so many different spots in the lineup. This is the first time we saw this particular one. And I know Kevin Woodley said, look, do you really want to pay a price for that type of guy who ends up being on your third line? But third line center is a really important position. Can't be an extremely important position, especially in the playoffs. I'm not saying he'll be stapled there for the rest of the year or anything like that, but the early returns against a good Bruins team I thought were pretty impressive.
It was the best he's looked. Like, flat out, that was his best. I know he's had other games where he scored twice, yep. But like, that was the best game that he's played since being acquired, without question, right? His positional intelligence is elite. But I don't know that he's brought, and this was something we talked about mm-hmm. before the trade, right? When the trade happened, we talked about the floor, we talked about the fit.
Mm-hmm.
But before it, when it was a hypothetical exercise, I mean, my one concern was, is Lindholm dynamic enough to bring what this team needs at the top end of their lineup? And if the answer is no, but he strengthens your bottom six, which, this is the other thing. What did that change do? Well, it pushed Bluger to the fourth line and gave Vancouver a more robust fourth line and, gave them a little bit of extra push in their third line, which had been flagging since the Dakota Joshua injury. And that's crucial, right? Like, this team's gained such a significant edge all season because their bottom six has been dynamic, has scored.
Yes.
Has, like, won them games. And I do think this team sort of reached a point over the course of this losing streak where that wasn't in their favor anymore, right? Where the Joshua injury, Hoglander's promotion, Mikheyev's sort of flagging
yep.
form, Pew Suter being up the lineup, like instead of this Suter, Hoglander, Lafferty fourth line that was picking its teeth with soft competition, you had this sort of fourth line morass with a group of guys who'd scored like two combined goals since Christmas. And those minutes weren't dependably in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
The third line wasn't your most reliable 5-on-5 line. And I think the Lindholm-Bluger shift kind of brought some of that identity back. Although I do think it also puts a lot of pressure on like Mikheyev to complement Pettersson effectively. Baines to become at least that. And we talked about it earlier this year, the Michael Amadio player type.
Baines is a fascinating part of this because
yes.
It feels like to make Lindholm at 3C work, even when Dakota Joshua comes back, you need another legitimate top nine forward in the mix, right? And now maybe you go out and acquire that by trade, right? But like even with Baines in the lineup, your wingers in the top six, it was Suter, Besser, Hoglander, Mikheyev. There's like one slam dunk top six winger in there, and that's Brock Besser. You know what I mean?
Right.
Everyone else, you would say, oh, okay, well, not that they can't do it, but it's not like an ideal, well, we feel great about it fit.
I mean, so I would say, though, my personal view is I think Hoglander matches that description. I think he was deeply overqualified on the fourth line, and I think Garland matches that description.
Yes.
It's just
they're just playing other places.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You don't have a single line that has two wingers that you'd be like, ha-ha, bang, bang, no
yeah.
question.
But
those guys are top six
in
wingers.
Part because you've chosen to spread them out
totally.
Around the lineup.
Yeah.
So, and that's fair enough as well. But I do think the Lindholm...
It's fair enough so long as you don't have to stem the bleeding at any point at the top of your lineup.
Yeah.
Which can happen in a playoff series, right? Like, which can happen if you bump into the Avalanche or the Oilers, right? Like, you might have to... Sometimes you just have to, stop the bleeding on top. As opposed to letting your depth win the matchup. So, yeah, it's an interesting one.
But I think... definitely saw enough from Lindholm with Garland. And I think, again, as you made the point, like Lindholm if you're counting on him to be an offensive driver for you, that's maybe not what he's going to be at this point. But how much have we talked about Connor Garland's ability to do that this year? So there is a bit of a natural fit there with Lindholm's ability to get open, use his shot, do so many of those things of that work in the defensive zone. He's a big body. He can forecheck, all of those things to complement Connor Garland and let Garland cook as the playmaker, the setup guy on that line. And then you bring Dakota Joshua back. And look, I've really liked what Arshdeep Bains has done. Maybe there's a spot for him higher up in the lineup. But as unfair as it feels to Teddy Bluger to kind of get him kicked off that line with how good he's been, like Lindholm, Joshua, Garland, that has a chance to be a real weapon as your third line down the stretch and into the playoffs.
Yeah, but if you end up reconstituting Bluger's line mates as like Bains, if Bains can sustain this,
yeah,
if Bains can be your Amadio type, right? And you have this reconstituted fourth line that has like him, Lafferty, and Bluger. I mean, that's not an L.
No.
By any means.
No.
But it will require Bains to maintain, you know, the like preternatural understanding of what Rick Tocchet hockey is all about, played at extraordinarily high energy once the adrenaline inevitably wears off. And this is what we always say when guys get called up, and we have to apply it again to Bains, which is, he's made a really impressive start, but the proof comes like game 7, 8, 9, you know, the consistency that's required to be a depth contributor in the NHL is just an incredibly high bar. And especially because Bane's success to this point has been built off of things like absolutely busting your hump on stop starts in the defensive end, defensive reads, like a lot of the energy.
IQ.
Oh yeah, and a lot of the high energy stuff part of the game that requires you to like outwork opponents and be more focused than opponents. Like, can he maintain that? That's sort of the question, because he's already shown us that he's at the level where he can be a helpful, like he's got it in him to be a helpful depth contributor. But as we've seen with guys like Noah Juulsen, it doesn't mean it's going to like click
It's not necessarily going to be there every night.
Or at least not off the bat. It might be another 12 months before he's at the point where he's at that level every night. You know?
Yeah, for sure. But I guess the question for me with Bains is, I mean, first of all, when he came up, you know, because you hear, like, I'm not scouting the Abbotsford games or anything like that, right? So you're mostly relying on reports about what he can do. And I was very curious to see, how does he look physically out there, right? How does he look like he's keeping up with the pace? And from a strength perspective, and he definitely passed that test. He has passed that test so far. As you said, you know, see what happens when, if that energy starts to flag at any point. I think the question for me now is, does he go back down this year? And I don't think they have to make that decision anytime soon. It'll depend a lot on Dakota Joshua's availability.
Well, he'll get papered down
when Dakota Joshua comes back.
No, they'll paper him down before the deadline.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Like on deadline day, you know, that you paper guys down to maintain their eligibility in the Calder Cup playoffs. And right now he'd be the only guy you'd expect to get papered down. You're not going to risk Amon on waivers. You're not going to risk Juulsen on waivers. So, you know, he will on paper go down on March 8th.
But will he play for Abbotsford again this year? That, to me, is an open question.
It's a really interesting question. I think a lot of it's going to be outside his control, too. It's going to be like, how does the Kessel thing play out?
Mm.
Do they bring in another body with size up front? Because that's the other thing. Okay, let's go through another one of our favorite things to do,
yes.
A thought exercise. Things Jamie and I don't like, actual
exercise.
So what
sports radio is known for, thought exercise.
Things we like, thought exercise.
Yeah.
If this works for another week, in terms of Pettersson, Miller,
Lindholm down the middle,
Bluger down the
middle,
does that in any way recalibrate what you think this team should be after, in terms of like a secondary out ahead of the deadline?
No, because I think we were thinking wings anyway, right?
Yeah, wings with size.
Yeah.
And ideally like some push.
Yeah.
Like, ideally, I mean, some offensive dynamism.
Go get Jake Guentzel, baby. Let's do it.
Sure.
You know you can sign him? I'm all in. No, I don't think it changed. I don't think it changes that. I think you're still looking to... I think then what you have is you have the spine of a really competitive forward group, and you're looking to fill it out around that, right? Because, as I said, you still have question marks. Like, you know, we love Pugh Suter on this show, but it's not as if he's a slam dunk in that role he's playing next to Miller and Besser. You know, Ilya Mikheyev, and I thought that line had some good moments against Boston. I thought generally it was pretty solid, actually, Mikheyev with Pettersson and Hoglander. But again, given where he's at in his injury recovery, is that a guy you want to be relying on in a really important position? So I think to me, there's still, not that any of them are like crisis situations where it's like, this is a big problem on your, in your lineup right now. I think that's what was with Andre Kuzmenko. It's like, this is a problem that they have to solve. I don't know if any of these players I'm describing are that, but there's areas to upgrade. There's opportunities to upgrade and get better on the wings in your top six, I think, undoubtedly, right now.
Kuzmenko trending toward being a healthy scratch for a second consecutive game in Calgary. Yeah, so I think you're right. We've known that they need size and ideally an additional penalty killing contributor and ideally a guy who can like take the goalie's eyes and maybe contribute a bit offensively at the very least. And that's, you know, still the need.
Frank Saravelli reporting earlier today, the Canucks are keeping close tabs on Brandon Duhaime.
Big fan.
Yeah. Big, 6'2" fan. Left shot.
Yeah.
6'2", 200 pounds. So big guy, bottom six, energy, pending UFA at 1.1.
Just a pain.
And, you know, I think I forget if it was Friedman or our pal Rick Dhaliwal. I think it was Friedman on Donnie and Dolly saying the Canucks are considering a lot of different things, things both big and small. And when we have people text in sometimes, you know, what's your kind of over-under on deals you expect the Canucks to make before the end of the year? I would say I'd be very surprised if they don't make two more moves. And they, it could just be as simple as Brandon Duhaime type and the bottom six and a depth defenseman, something like that. But that's my kind of baseline expectation, is they will go get a guy like a Brandon Duhaime or equivalent, and then you can scale up the possibilities from there. But it would not surprise me at all. And in fact, I'm expecting a player like that, very similar, to be here before the deadline, because there's just, we've heard them talk about it too much, that need for size.
One other thing that we haven't somehow addressed yet, which is as the Canucks began to churn that game in their favor on Saturday night, you know who was a big, big driver of it? Is Nikita Zadorov. Just like breaking forechecks with his feet.
He looked awesome, man. He was so good.
We've talked about this a fair bit.
Like, he was like making plays in the offensive zone and stuff. Yeah.
No, this is going down low. Like, this is Zadorov at his best. One thing that's been sort of interesting is when they first acquired Zadorov, you know, I was hyping up the chaos that would ensue, and then he played a very contained game, I think, as he adjusted to his new surroundings. And all of a sudden, we saw the secondary puck-moving push that Zadorov can bring to your lineup against the Bruins, and man, was it vital in helping the Canucks win. Not just the assists that he picked up off the set play, but also just the way that he started helping them log heavy shifts on a pretty consistent basis as the game turned in their favor. You can see like when you have that secondary push from the back end, this team has more options in terms of how they can attack, in terms of how they can transport the puck. And I still think an additional body like that would mean a lot. Like one more guy who can give you some
push.
Who
can move the puck a little bit.
Man, I think that would be huge.
Yeah, well, I think, look, well, here, how about this? You were saying, Does the Lindholm down the middle look change what you think they should do at the deadline? And I don't think it does up front, but are you looking at forward or defense more right now? Like if they could make one move before the deadline, are you targeting the blue line or are you targeting a guy up front for the Canucks?
I mean,
puck mover. Or is it as simple as best player available?
No, additional puck mover has always been the thing. And for me, it's more about purchasing like Hronek Hughes insurance. Not that anyone you're going to be able to land is going to be an actual like facsimile or even a reasonable facsimile, but at least like a stylistic fit so that you don't lose the way that that pair can play. Now, you're going to lose it if you lose Quinn Hughes. Don't get me wrong. But
yes.
But
correct.
But, you know, just someone so that at least it doesn't throw off entirely how you attack as a team. You know, like right now, and we're so not used to it in Vancouver, but right now that pair bends the game, right? The Canucks have like one forward line that's reliably driven play 5-on-5 in minutes away from that pair. And in minutes with that pair, they have four forward lines to drive play, right? I mean,
and that forward line is not together right now because Joshua's injured.
Truly, like, exactly. This team's minutes at this point should be separated between on-ice Hughes Hronek minutes and off-ice Hughes Hronek minutes, right? And in the past, it's been like, with Pettersson on the ice, they outscore their opposition. Or with JT Miller on the ice, they do this versus that. And it's like, now it's just like, all you have to do is hold serve in your non-Hronek Hughes minutes, because you are going to outscore your opposition in the minutes that they play. So to me, whatever insurance policy you can buy to protect that edge, like, to me, that's the highest leverage thing you can do ahead of the deadline, unless you're getting a game-breaking, unless you're landing Jake Guentzel, unless you're landing like a Jordan Eberle quality guy, like a real top of the lineup guy. Unless you're doing that, I think that's the sort of highest leverage depth add you can bring in would be like, I don't know, and I know it didn't work out here for him because of concussions, but it's like, I'd way rather see this team add Travis Dermott than just about anyone up front, because of the fact that, like, in my mind's eye, it's like, okay, well, you know, he can give you some options for some push at the bottom end of your lineup if you're all healthy, and then also if one of Hughes or Hronek go down, does he help you sort of plug and play with a guy who can at least, like, play that style, move the puck in that style?
See, for me, I think it's legit top four defensemen of basically any stylistic description. I guess I would say right shot. I would add that caveat because they have so many left shots already.
I think they'd agree with you.
Right. So I think just, like, take any style. If they are a legit guy you feel really comfortable playing 20 plus minutes a night in the playoffs, like, guy you're excited about having in that role, go get them. That's first and foremost for me. Then you get to, yeah, as you said, Guentzel, Eberle, right? And then I think beyond that, then you can start to kind of parse by style and sort by style of player. And I agree with you at that point, right? Like, you know, we've brought up Alexander Carrier as a UFA out of Nashville. A player like that,
love that,
would make a ton of sense. Or the big body guy farther down the forward lineup as well.
Yeah, someone needs to do the go to Nashville and get both Carrier and Novak trade. That's the play.
I like it.
Someone's got to make it. They cost 2.6 combined.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
You know?
That would be an interesting one.
It's the way to go.
It is interesting, though, with Baines, because with Joshua back, and as you mentioned, the Phil Kessel thing, and the latest I heard was that pending something going really, really haywire, he's going to sign with the Canucks. I believe that was what Rick Dhaliwal was reporting earlier, or last week, I should say. I mean, it's going to be a pretty crowded forward group here. Again, once healthy. But the great thing about Rick Tocchet is he doesn't leave a lot of mystery about how he's evaluating his players. You know, you can tell pretty quickly from the minutes, from his commentary, if he is very happy or unhappy with a player. Like, think back to when he came in and Andre Kuzmenko's minutes started to dwindle right away. Even last season, right? We started to notice that. That wasn't a coincidence. There was something there. On the flip side, the fact that Arshdeep Baines is already playing, he's not playing fourth line minutes. Like, he has clearly set himself above in the minute hunt from guys on that fourth line. That says a lot to me about what Rick Tocchet sees in Arshdeep Baines. So it might be difficult, and there might be, like, waiver things and contractual things that end up pushing him back down to the playoffs. But I think if Rick Tocchet is setting his lineup right now, he wants Arshdeep Baines in there. Like, I don't know how else to interpret what we've seen and how he's used him through these first handful of games here. And that's a huge, huge deal if all of a sudden Arshdeep Baines has impressed Rick Tocchet to that degree to figure into a hypothetical playoff lineup.
Yeah. Canucks have some flexibility, but yeah, when Joshua and Carson Soucy are both back, Baines is your, like, only waiver-exempt guy.
Yeah.
That said, I don't think you worry too much about waiving Nils Hamann if it comes to it.
Yeah.
You know, especially because he's got two years of high one-way salary. I think that's a pretty... I think he could pass through.
Phil DiGiuseppe?
Well, I don't think you'd waive Phil DiGiuseppe. He's on a two-way, so I don't think you'd waive Phil DiGiuseppe. I think you'd waive Nils Hamann first. You're just far more protected. So, yeah, they're going to have some options here, and Baines is definitely going to earn a look. But, again, maintaining that, that's really – maintaining that energy level is a lot easier said than done.
But, man, if he's an option, that's is just fascinating. And another part of a great story for Arshdeep Baines.
No question.
The fact that we're even having this conversation for him is really, really cool. All right, that does it for us today. Good to be back on the show. It's Canucks game day tomorrow. They take on Sidney Crosby and the Penguins. We'll have your coverage here. Keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.